Okay, we will continue on about the four establishments of mindfulness. And tonight we'll talk specifically about the first one, mindfulness of the body. Okay, so we'll start visualizing the mirror field and ourselves surrounded by all those sentient beings, whether it's the ones you like, the ones you don't like, the ones you approve of, the ones you despise. You have to put all of your opinions down and look at all of them equally as worthy of happiness, because that's what they want, to be happy and to be free of suffering. So it's not that some people are more worthy of happiness than others. That's a very worldly way of thinking, isn't it? You know? But what we're trying to do in cultivating bodhicitta is to see everybody equally and everybody in an equally good light, not an equally bad light. Okay? So when we talk about seeing all sentient beings equally, we can really have a hard time with that, because in our culture, we certainly don't see everybody as equal. Or we see them as equal in some ways, but certainly not equal in terms of being worthy of happiness, being worthy of freedom. But in Buddhism, when we think about the desirable qualities, we know that everybody has the potential to develop them, and that everybody would certainly be happy when they're able to do that. So we're not judging and evaluating people based on social status, financial ability, who are our friends or who are enemies. Rather, we're really looking at the heart of each sentient being and what is their deepest wish, their deepest aspiration. And it's in that way that we can really train our mind to see everybody as equal. When we do, then we can start treating people better. Because usually the people we don't like, we shun, we complain about them. People we do like, we go out of our way to help them and praise them. And everybody else, we don't care about until they start influencing us one way or the other. So it's important to look in people's heart and what is most important to them, not how they appear superficially as we judge them through our opinions, our values, our everything. So take a minute and try and do that. then seeing that they've all been kind to us, in, if not in this life, in previous lives, and not just once, but many, many times. So switch how you view other living beings. And in that way, wish them well, especially the joy of full awakening. And to bring that about, we have to increase our own abilities. And so we seek full awakening to have all the qualities we need to be of the greatest benefit to all beings. And that's why we're here this evening. Okay. Our opinions really get in the way, don't they? Yeah. Person does one small thing we don't like, and they are blacklisted. They do two small things that we don't like, and they're hopeless. Three small things we don't like, and we never want to see them again. It's incredible, isn't it, the way our mind works? And then we complain that nobody likes us and people don't treat us very well. But how do we treat them? And how do we, what is our thought about them? Okay, so just to review a little bit, yeah, some of the, how we see the four objects. Okay, so these first four of how we usually conceive of the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena in relationship to the self. These are quite interesting. And if we look, we have all of these kind of assumptions. And they influence us quite a bit. But so often we're not aware that we have these assumptions. Yeah. So the first one is that we... my heroine. Glasses. Thank you. Oh, there's people sitting out here. Okay. First one is conceiving the body to be the residence of the self. Yeah. So what is your body? It's where I am. Yeah. I am somewhere in this, or I am this. Yeah, and I'm certainly, you know, not that, and I'm certainly not your bodies. I am this, you know. There is an inherently existent self that is real, and it abides in this body. Yeah, so you better think this body is stupendous when you see it. Because I need people to think I'm stupendous. And also, you need to think that I'm stupendous. It's better for you. Yeah? Don't you want to get along with me? Well, okay. So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, the self is here. In the young adult group, we were... the question came up. It was in the context of lying. If, you know, you put on some new clothes or you have, do your hair differently and you ask somebody, how do I look? Yeah. Then, you know, is it, or somebody else does that and they ask us, how do I look? Then, you know, the question came up, well, I don't think they look good, but I don't want to hurt their feelings, so I tell them they do look good. Yeah. And then it's interesting how people really want to hear and they need to hear that they look good. Yeah. They need that affirmation because, you know, people so often judge us by our looks, don't they? And we judge them by their looks. And here we are as a group of people who throw our makeup away or never had makeup to start with, you know, got rid of our curlers and our hairdo, all of our hairdo stuff, you know, kind of the your blow dryer and you know, everything. We don't look at the magazines for the latest haircut. Yeah. And then, my goodness, we wear the same clothes every day. What are people going to think? And what do you think if you see somebody who's not a monastic who wears the same clothes every day? Oh, they must be poor. They probably haven't washed and they smell. And what kind of person is that? Yeah. Automatically, just how they look, we start judging. Yeah. So we're judging the person by looking at the body because the person is inside the body. Yeah, and we feel that too. But if somebody says, where exactly in the body are you? Yeah, what do you point to? Are you up here? Yeah, you are you up here? Yeah. Are you in here? Are you here? Are you here? Are you your beating heart, or are you at your heart chakra? Or maybe you're somewhere in the back of the of your mouth, because you make all those words come out. It's interesting. Okay. So this is something that we really investigate, especially when looking at the body. Yeah. The second one is that conceiving the feelings to be what the self, the I, enjoys and experiences. Okay, so we all want happy feelings. We do not want painful feelings. Yeah. And this is a really important thing, you know. Okay, maybe you think my body isn't so beautiful, but don't you dare hurt it, yeah? Okay, we are super sensitive to sensations in our body, aren't we? Yeah, we just like tune into everything. But the way we tune into it is not the mindfulness of the body. The way we tune into it is with grasping at pleasure and grasping at not wanting pain. So whenever we look at the body and look at the feelings in the body, that's what we're looking at, you know. Oh, okay, good body, I feel pleasure. Oh, bad body, I feel pain. Yeah. And if it's a certain degree of pain, well, forget it. I'm in bed. You know, it's just, I can't handle things. It just hurts too much. Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, I can't do this because, you know, it's usually my little toe that hurts, but now it's my big toe. Yeah. You don't know how painful your big toe can get. I was awake all night one time because there was some kind of boil or infection in my big toe. Yeah, and it hurt so bad I couldn't sleep. Sympathy? Okay. Yeah, that's better. But the feelings are what the I experiences, and we want them to be pleasurable ones. Yeah, we don't want painful ones. Okay, the mind, we think the mind is the real self because it is what thinks and processes all of the cognitions. So we think the mind is the self. And it feels that way, doesn't it? Yeah. When we say, I think, da-da-da-da-da-da, we're saying it like the mind is the self, because it's the self that thinks. I think, da-da-da-da-da. Okay. But then we say, did he lose his mind? As if the mind is detachable. And it fell off and he lost his mind. Okay. Or we sometimes talk about our mind like that. We say, you know, my mind just isn't cooperating today. Yeah. My mind is sleepy. Okay. When we use my, then we're not seeing the self as the mind. We're seeing the self as the owner or possessor of the mind. Yeah. My mind is uncooperative. My mind is sleepy. My mind, I'm a subtle genius. No, is that what he said? Subtle, not subtle genius, nothing subtle about him. Something, what was the adjective he used? Yeah, oh, come on, you guys, huh? You know who I'm talking about. Yeah. There was a word. What?
Stable genius.
That's, yes. He's a stable genius. So the person is unstable. The mind, yeah. But he's, when we say a person, when you say, I am a stable genius, then you're saying the I is the mind. When you have, say, I have a mind that is a stable genius, then the mind is your possession, and the I and the self and the mind are different. It's interesting, isn't it, how we go back and forth between being our body or our mind and then seeing them as our possessions. Yeah. His Holiness uses the example to show that. He says, if it were possible to change your body for somebody else's body, yeah, you would do it, wouldn't you? Yeah. We say yes, as if the I is there and the body is a possession and you trade it in for a new one, but the I remains the same. It's just the possession. It's like getting a new pair of shoes. Okay, you got a new body. Yeah. I mean, like, nice to look at rebirth in that same way, isn't it? Not be so concerned about it. We look at the mind the same way. You know, if we could change minds with somebody else who was an actual stable genius, we would do it. Or if we could change minds with somebody who was a bodhisattva, yeah. So again, the feeling there's an I, it's not going to change, but again, I'll, you know, trade in my mind and get a different one that I like better. Yeah, because my mind is my possession. But here, mostly, you know, when we come back to kind of how do we conceive of the self, we usually, sometimes it's the body, but sometimes it's the mind. Yeah. Okay, the third one was, that was the third one. Okay, and the fourth was conceiving phenomena, especially the mental factors, yeah, as something that makes the self either worthwhile or worthless, or not worthwhile, okay? So, oh, I have, you know, great intelligence. Yeah, intelligence is a possession, and it makes me great. Okay, so it makes the person afflictive. I'm angry. Yeah, anger has arisen. Yeah, and that afflicts the self. Yeah, generosity has arisen. And that makes the self feel good until stinginess has arisen, and then the self doesn't feel good. Okay, doesn't feel worthwhile. Okay, so just to review that and to keep these four in mind as we meditate and develop mindfulness on the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Okay, then last time we also talked about the four, and each one, when we talk about the four distortions, okay, holding what is foul is clean, holding what is dukkha or undesirable by nature as something wonderful, holding something that is impermanent and changes every moment as permanent, and holding something that doesn't have a self as having the self. Yeah. And so while those can apply to basically all of these, all four, we tend to, when we meditate on what's foul, do that in terms of the body. When we meditate on what's unsatisfactory, is we do that in terms of the feelings. But then you say, but my happy feelings are not unsatisfactory. Why should I see them as unsatisfactory? Buddhism makes me depressed. Well, that's not what the Buddha is saying to do when we meditate on the feelings, is to see that even our feelings of happiness and joy don't last very long. They're impermanent, okay? And, and if you have a pleasant feeling in samsara for, you know, because of a contact with a certain object, you know, it seems really pleasant for a while until it actually becomes painful, yeah? Like the pleasure we get from eating eventually becomes painful. The pleasure we get when we can stand up after sitting for hours, you know? But then you stand up for hours and all you want to do is sit. Okay. This became very evident to me when I went from a full ordination in Taiwan, because I had mastered in the Tibetan tradition, finally, being able to sit for many, many hours without moving. And then I go to Taiwan. They don't sit so much, you know, but you stand for hour after hour after hour. And my legs swelled up. Yeah. So it's, you know, what you think is going to make you happy, after a while, it makes you miserable. And every wonderful thing you have has a downside. We were talking about this with the young adults, too. You know, you saw in the skit, everything that was going to make her happy, from a Chanel bag to, what was the first one? Korean barbecue, a Chanel bag, and then Prince Charming. Yeah, and you think this is going to be it, and phew, yeah. How is that going to make you happy forever? You know, Korean barbecue, I've never had that. Oh, I must be missing something in samsara. Yeah. I had Prince Charming. Yeah, that was good. He was nice. Why he lasted. Yeah. But it wasn't always nice. Yeah, was it? As soon as you link up with somebody and you are in love, is it always that happy feeling? Yeah. Well, what interferes with it? He does this and this and this, and he has this and this and this and this. Yeah. And nothing to do with us. We always are cooperative. Yeah. When he does something we don't like, we just bring it up very gently. You idiot, why did you do that? And then, you know, he tries to explain. And again, we're very tolerant. You expect me to believe that? You jerk. You know, tell me the truth. Okay. You know how it goes. Don't you? Yeah. Do you? Okay. Thank goodness for the used husband stories and the used you know, you get tired of him, you go trade him in for somebody else. Yeah, it's no, what is it?
No deposit, no return.
No, you can return him. No, it's, you know, divorce, no questions asked, you know. No fault divorce. Yeah, it's no fault divorce. Yeah, take him to the used husband store, you know, before he takes you to the used wife store. Yeah. But that's the way we act, isn't it? Yeah, trade somebody in. Okay, so we usually meditating on foulness. You know, we do that to counteract seeing the body is clean. Meditating on unsatisfactoriness, we do in terms of the feelings. Yeah, because they don't last and they aren't true happiness. And then meditating on impermanence in terms of the mind. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Our mind changes a lot, doesn't it? Yeah. Stable genius? Are you a stable genius? I'm stably unpredictable. Yeah. Okay. Mind always changing. Yeah. Cognizing something new opinion, new desire, yeah, always changing. And then with phenomena, there we meditate that, you know, what we think doesn't, that has a self, doesn't. Yeah. And so actually the self, when you just talk about the I goes into the fourth aggregate, miscellaneous factors. Yeah. Because, you know, the five aggregates contain all conditioned phenomena. So then, okay, well, the I is a conditioned phenomena. Oh, which one of the aggregates is it? Yeah. So you throw it into the fourth one because that's the grab bag of everything that doesn't fit in to the other four. Okay, and in that way, meditating on the body and being foul, we understand true dukkha. Meditating on the feelings as being unsatisfactory, then we focus on the true cause of dukkha. When we meditate on the mind being impermanent, it gives us the idea of true cessation, if we could control the mind. And then meditating on phenomena, especially the mental factors, but everything else too, you know, seeing it as lacking a self. And here, self could mean either a person, but from the Prasangika view, self means inherent existence. And then that connects us to true paths. Okay. So now we're going to, yeah?
When we're meditating on the feelings and seeing them as unsatisfactory, mm-hmm. and if we're doing the meditation on the feelings we want to cultivate, as love and compassion or mm-hmm. generosity, how...
Okay. First of all, love and compassion... Or put it this way, when we say feelings in Dharma context, it refers to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. So in that context, love and compassion are not feelings. In English, we say that they're feelings, but in Dharma language, they're not feelings. Yeah, they're mental factors.
The other that really go into that category of the mental factors.
What?
The other feelings that match with the category of the mental factors, like, I don't know, like joy, it's a mental factor, or...
Yeah, well, okay, let's say you have love for sentient beings. Your mind is going to have a pleasant feeling. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. So, you know, depending upon what mental factors are prominent, then there will be a feeling there as well.
Yeah. And my question is how, if we are meditating in those feelings, uh-huh. like positive feelings, how can we go to the idea of they are unsatisfactory if they are, I don't know.
At our level as sentient beings, yeah, pretty much every feeling we have is unsatisfactory. So when we can really see that, that helps us generate renunciation of samsara. Okay? Because in samsara, I mean, samsara is unsatisfactory, and every feeling we have, even if it's a pleasurable one, is unsatisfactory. Yeah. Okay, does that answer your question? Okay, so mindfulness of the body. We are embodied beings. How does that phrase hit you? We are embodied beings. It comes in the three principal aspects of the path, too. You know, embodied beings. Yeah, Do you have a special thought that comes up when you hear that expression?
I think in the three principles, it's for you embodied beings bound by the craving for existence. So then it's not as much personal as it is like a total understanding of every living being who's in samsara mm-hmm. is bound by the craving for existence. It's why they're embodied.
Yeah.
So it explains a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we react so much to feelings from our body, let alone feelings, you know, mental feelings. So just by having a body, you know, then all this craving for pleasant feelings comes up and all this antagonism towards unpleasant feelings. Yeah. When you have a headache, it's like, oh, I wish it would go away, you know. Or you got cut, or you had surgery, or, you know, you're something in your body aches and pains, you know, then, yeah, it's unsatisfactory. And that's not just us, it's, you know, all embodied beings. Mm-hmm. So then the question arises, what is a healthy relationship with our body? Yeah, if so much of our body gives us pain, and then so much of our craving, you know, and craving is an affliction that's really very good friends with ignorance and keeps samsara alive. Yeah, if our body is, you know, the source of a lot of our craving, then, you know, how do we relate to our body? Because when we look at it from one perspective, it's like, I want to get rid of it. Yeah. But the thing is, while we're in samsara, you get rid of this body, you get another one right away. It doesn't do any good. Yeah. Suicide does not solve any problems. In fact, it could make your problem worse. Yeah. So how do we relate to this body that, yeah? Well, when we talk about precious human life, yeah, there it's the body that is the basis of our precious human life, because we don't have a human mind unless we have a human body. Yeah, you can't. If you're an elephant, you have elephant aggregates. It's not that you can have, you know, a human body and then the four mental aggregates be an elephant. Or you can have your mental aggregates be human while your body is an elephant. Yeah. No, it's together. You're embodied and then, yeah, so much attachment to the body. Because it's where the self is, and it is the self. And the body wants pleasure, and the purpose of my life is to give that body pleasure. Because if when it doesn't have pleasure, whoa, it is difficult to get along with, isn't it? When your body's in pain, it's like, oh, I can't, you know, this body is... Okay, source of much unhappiness. But when we talk about our precious human life and the possibility for us to attain awakening, yeah, then the human body is something valuable and we should respect it and use it wisely. So instead of using it to chase pleasure, yeah, use it as the basis for our human intelligence and for our mind to engage with the Dharma. And our body can cooperate and do some prostrations and mandala offerings and other things too that are virtuous. Okay. But yeah, I'm giving you different things to think about when it's when we do mindfulness of the body. Okay. We're embodied, and we can't, you know, unless we're born in the formless realm, we're going to have some kind of body, but you're still in samsara in the form, the formless. Although, according to Tantra, you would still have a very subtle body in the formless realm. Okay, we are embodied beings, and much of our lives revolves around our bodies. Thus, the body is the first of the four objects to be examined. Establishing mindfulness of the body brings a clear understanding of what the body is and what it means to have a body. Yeah. Are we free when we have a body? We're not free, but we say, I am free. You know, in conventional things, when we say, I'm free, we think, my body is free to do whatever my mind tells it to do. Yeah, I have choice, and the body falls. But when you really think about it, having a body puts us in a very unfree state. Because taking care of it, worrying about it, you know, the body gets sick, and all of a sudden you're sure that you have kidney failure or cancer or, you know, you just had a stroke or something like that. The worry we have about our body. Do you worry about your body? Small sensations like, oh, no. Oh no, maybe it's really, really sick. And if my body has an unpleasant feeling, then I can't do this and I can't do that. And I can't eat what I want to because it's not healthy for my body. And yeah. Yeah. My body wants to do this. I want to go running, but I can't go running. Yeah. Okay, establishing mindfulness of the body brings a clear understanding of what the body is and what it means to have a body. Okay, we're going through this pretty slowly because if you look, each sentence is something to meditate on. Yeah. Mindfulness of the body involves reflecting on the causes of the body, the nature of the body, and the result of the body. So these three are often come together when we're analyzing something. What is its cause? What is its nature? And what is its result? Okay. So the causes of your body. What's the cause of your body? What are the causes of your body? Okay, sperm and egg, and all the food that you've eaten since there was conception. Imagine how high that pile of food would be if it was everything that you ate since the time of conception. Okay, what is the result of the body? Hello? A corpse. Imagine how high the pile of corpses would be. Yeah. What's the nature of the body? What does the body do? Yeah, yawns. That's it. It yawns. It is a manufacturing unit all to itself. It manufactures pee, it manufactures poop, and sweat, and earwax, and stuff in your eyes, and what else? Phlegm. Oh, yeah. You know, cough up some phlegm. Yeah, our body is, a multi multi-productive thing, produces many different kinds of things, yeah, that we all get rid of as soon as we can. Yeah, and the body, we don't want to be separated from the body because that's where the self is. But once we are, it's like, blech. Or if we, think of what our body is going to look like after it dies, or we look at somebody else's corpse. Yeah. You know, Prince Charming was so good looking. Like, wow. Yeah. You don't believe me? Wasn't Prince Charming just so good looking? And then what does he look like when he's a corpse? And not just look like as a corpse, smell like when he's not wearing aftershave or deodorant. Of course, I don't think a corpse sweats, but maybe he sweat before he died. You know, we just go, ugh. Okay. So mindfulness of the body involves reflecting on the causes of the body, the nature of the body, and the result of the body. Mindfulness investigates the body and sees that although it appears to the contrary, it is not clean. Although it appears, foul, it appears clean, it is not. Although it appears attractive, it is not. Although we think of our body as not changing and something permanent, it changes. Yeah. So it is not clean or attractive. It is impermanent. And it cannot provide genuine happiness or pleasure. And it is not a self. Yeah. When you look at the body, yeah, it's interesting how we use language. We look at somebody's body, let's say they're dead, they're lying in the casket, okay? And you look and we say, oh, he's so peaceful. Okay, yeah, don't you, grandma looks so peaceful. As if that corpse were a person. Yeah, is the corpse a person? Is that corpse grandma? No, it's a corpse. It's not a person. Yeah. But we'll say, he looks so peaceful. Mm-hmm. Or it's interesting. Somebody dies, and then we say, oh, I wonder where he is reborn. Seeing the self as something permanent and unchanging, it came out of this body and it's going to be reborn in another, and it's the same self, hasn't changed a bit. Yeah. And I love, and it shows these concepts, show so easily when we look at how we use language. When I saw Lama Osa one time and I came out, and he was still itty-bitty. And somebody said, did he recognize you? Did he act like Lama? Did he speak like Lama? Yeah, as if Lama just picked up and went in there. Yeah. I had a funny interaction with Lama Zofa about this. Let me see how... Remember how the discussion went. It was at, we were both listening to teachings by Geshe Zopa in Deer Park. And Geshe-la had been teaching about the specific self and the general self. Yeah. And And then Rinpoche, I was talking to Rinpoche, you know, we were, I don't know, folding our robes or doing something. And he asked about Sirkum Rinpoche. And, you know, something about, does he, you know, is the new Sirkum Rinpoche kind of like the old one? And I looked at Rinpoche, I said, no, you know, he acts differently. And Rinpoche said, but he's the same person. And then, you know, because that's the way we talk about it, the same person. And then both of us just laughed. You know, Rinpoche realized what he said, you know. Yeah, because that's the way we use language. Yeah, it's the same person because he died and was reborn in this body. Same. Mm. Okay. The causes of the body are the sperm and the egg. These are not attractive substances that we like to see. They come from the lower part of the body, and people usually consider them unclean. If they were here on the table, you have the egg with the blood around it, you have the sperm in some kind of goo. Yeah. Do people go, oh, these look so beautiful? We say, clean it up, ASAP. Okay. If they were here on the table, we would clean the table. They are not like honey, which we enjoy, or milk, which we appreciate. Are they? They're substances that come from the body that if we just look at the sperm and egg that gave rise to this thing, it's like, ugh. Yes?
These specific examples of honey and milk are interesting because they both come from the bodies of other beings.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we consider those clean. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Honey's clean. Milk's clean. Yeah. The three whites and the three sweets in Indian culture. You know, the three whites, milk, butter, and yogurt, yeah, are considered very favorable substances. Mm-hmm. I wonder if a human woman, if they made cheese out of her milk, then what? You already made a face. Yeah.
Someone's tried it.
Yeah, you think someone tried it? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Mindfulness investigates the body and sees that although it appears to the contrary, it is not clean and attractive. It is impermanent. It cannot provide genuine happiness or pleasure. And it is not a self. That reduces our attachment to it, which decreases worry and obsession about the body. The more attached we are to the body, the more we worry about how it looks. And we compare our body to other people's bodies. We compare our bodies to movie stars' bodies, to the bodies of models and magazines. None of us look like that. Yeah. And then we say, oh, I should look like that, but I don't. Oh, what's wrong with me? Yeah. Better, you know, get some more plastic here, and get a facelift here, and shave off some fat here, and move that fat somewhere else where I want it. You know, we become so fussy about how we look, let alone the feelings of the body and how we feel. Yeah. Body, oh, my stomach, you know, oh, this, oh, that. You know, always so worried. Hmm? And there's no, as long as we're alive, there's no end to the worry about the body unless we do this practice and we, you know, start seeing the body for what it really is and start seeing craving for what it really is and then, you know, do something about how we look at our body. The nature of our present body is not desirable, even though superficially it may have a good shape, color, or size. But if it were cut open, we would see muscles, tissue, tendons, organs, bone, blood, marrow, and all sorts of other beautiful things. Yeah. I was looking up some disease recently, and they had a picture of an enlarged spleen. How often do you think about your spleen? Do you even know where your spleen is? Yeah, it's here. Yeah. And it's not that big, but this spleen was like this big. Yeah, somehow squished in here. Yeah. Yeah, we have a very good anatomy book in the library. Quite good to spend some time looking at it. Okay, nature of our present body is not desirable, even though superficially it may have a good shape, color, or size. But don't you want your body to either be a little taller or a little shorter than it is? Okay, a little thinner or a little fatter than it is. Yeah, look older than you look so that people treat you more respectfully. Or look younger than you look so that people treat you more respectfully. Okay. Look at anatomy books with photographs of the inside of the body or observe an autopsy as many Theravadan monastics do. Doing this counteracts unrealistic notions that the body is clean and attractive and the source of pleasure. Yeah. So this, you know, in our society, people are so, the amount of time and energy focused on the body and the just even how the body looks, you know, let alone if it's healthy or not. The amount of time and resources, how much money people spend on making the body look good. Yeah, by getting the right clothes that are the in color with the right design this year. Yeah, and the shoes that match, you know, like real super pointy ones at the toes, so that are 5-inch heels. They're really comfortable to walk around in all day. Huh? Yeah, but you've got to because that's what everybody else wears. Isn't it? You look at, you know, they just had the G7 meeting, or they're having it, you know, and they all, you know, brought their spouses. And the women, I mean, the way the women have to look. Yeah. And of course, the women are wearing as little as possible, and the men are wearing T-shirts with a long sleeve shirt, with a warm jacket, with a tie that's like making it so that there's no air going in and out. You know, how do you set the temperature in the room when some people are freezing cold and some people are very hot? Yeah. Okay, no matter how expensive and well-prepared is the food we eat, it all becomes poop, okay? Our body is like a machine for producing filth. You know, when the communists first took over China, I mean, everybody was really poor. And there were people whose job it was to go around every morning and collect soil. Okay. The soil that was collected was people's poop, because they collected it and then they used it as fertilizer. Yeah. It was also the time where they got pulled out every nail that wasn't needed from something to melt down so that they had metal. And talk about recycling. But, yeah, so that your poop became quite valuable then. So our body is like a machine for producing filth. If this machine works properly, our stool is neither too hard nor too soft. But if something goes wrong with the machine, we suffer from diarrhea or constipation. Yippee! Which one is worse? They're both pretty bad. Everything that comes out of our body, urine, feces, sweat, saliva, earwax, mucus, and so forth, is considered dirty, and we wipe it away. And what's interesting, too, is when you're served a plate of food, the food is clean, isn't it? As soon as you put it in your mouth and chew it, if you were to spit it out, would you see it as clean? Would other people see it as clean? No. What made that clean food that was on the plate dirty? It going into our body for half a minute and getting chewed, and then it became dirty. Interesting, isn't it? We can make things dirty super quickly. Can we make them clean again that quickly? Mm-mm. Okay. But if something goes wrong with the machine, we'd suffer from diarrhea or constipation. Everything that comes out of our body, urine, feces, sweat, saliva, earwax. Oh, isn't earwax lovely? Yeah. Oh, I love you, even your earwax. Yeah, they should have a love song about that. Yeah, this one, yeah, you wrote something about the body before. Yeah, you should do another one about
earwax.
Yeah, earwax, saliva, sweat. Yeah, vomit. Yeah, vomit. Yeah. And then either constipation or diarrhea. Yeah, use your music-making abilities and do another performance for us, okay? Okay, so all those things that come out of our body are considered dirty, and we wipe them away. Unless we use our human body properly by not using it to harm others, and instead by using it to benefit them as much as we can, unless we can do that, eating food and taking care of this body do not have much meaning. The context of being a Dharma practitioner, unless we use our body, yeah, to do purification, to create merit, to use it to benefit others, yeah, then all this energy taking care of it is really not worth it. If we concentrate properly, we see that each part of the body is unattractive. Our eyes may look beautiful on the outside, but if we looked at the inside of the eyeball, it is hardly beautiful. Have you ever seen the inside of an eyeball? We have it. Oh, yeah, I've never seen it, yeah. But I'll take His Holiness's word for it, that it's hardly beautiful. Similarly, someone may have soft, beautiful skin, but underneath it are blood, intestines. Oh, your intestines just turn me on, you know. Yeah, which one, the small one or the big one? Yeah. Oh, I like both your intestines. Woo! You know. Okay, beneath the soft, beautiful skin are blood, intestines, a stomach, liver, brain, lymph, and a skeleton. Yeah, Venerable Benyan, when he was teaching the Vinaya and talking about the first parijika, you know, sexual contact, he was saying that, you know, we're just so addicted. We crave soft and smooth. You know, when we think of somebody else's body, we want, you know, their skin should be soft and smooth. Yeah. And I thought about that. Yeah. Some people's bodies, they're pretty hairy. I don't know if that's soft and smooth.
Like my tree.
Yeah. Oh, like my tree, yeah, soft and smooth. Yeah. No, she's not hairy. She's furry. Furry and hairy are different. Yeah. Yeah, we like fur. Yeah, yeah, but it's interesting. He said we just crave soft and smooth. And as, when he said that, I thought, that's why Shanti Deva says, when you have sexual desire, hug a pillow, soft and smooth. Yeah, and it might smell better. And it doesn't talk back. Okay, the body is so delicate that it's almost unbelievable that all of these organs function together so that the body remains alive. Talk to anybody who's in med school or nursing school and they'll say this. I mean, it really is when you consider all these systems in our body that have to work properly to be healthy, it's amazing. Yeah, that they do. We usually see our own and others' bodies are solid, permanent, and real. Yeah, that's another thing. When people die, and you know, we want their body. Every culture, you have to take the body and then do something special with the body. As, you know, you wash the body or perfume the body, you put it in an expensive casket, you decorate it. You know, you have to, when somebody dies, yeah, you have to choose the clothes they're going to be buried in. Yeah. And then you have to think, oh, what would mom or dad want to be buried in? Mom and dad don't care about that point. They're dead, you know. But everybody looks. And I remember one of my high school friends, her mother had Hodgkin's, and she was ill for a long time and then died. But at her funeral, which was open casket, some people were saying, oh, I haven't seen her look that good in a long time. Yeah, because they embalm the body and they make it look beautiful, you know. And you want makeup on your body, they'll make up, they'll, you know, put all your makeup on your body. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. But when we look deeply at the nature of the body, it becomes obvious that regarding it as clean and beautiful is a wrong conception. unless it's so-and-so who just is so good-looking. Yeah. And we are such suckers for people that we consider good-looking, aren't we? You know, we treat them differently. My sister, when she was about 40, you know, she said to me, "Oh, you know, it used to be when I walked in Costco or Walgreens or something, there were so many people who wanted to help me. Now, nobody looks and asks if they can help me find what I need. Just based on how you look." Amazing how we judge people. Okay. The result of the body is a corpse. In meditation, we visualize a body that has recently died. If you can't visualize it, I have pictures of the autopsy that I attended, and I also have pictures of the bodies of some of the people who died in the tsunamis in Thailand. You know, the bodies that were found washed up on the beach later on. Incredible to, you know, what they did in the pictures is the bodies were all laid out and they had people's ID cards next to the bodies because you would look at the bodies and you couldn't tell who it was. You'd look at the picture and the ID and you'd look at the corpse and, you know, they were so bloated and affected by being washed and trembled around in the waves that you couldn't really tell who was who. Yeah. But it's interesting how we want to bury the body of our relative. And if there is a mix-up in the mortuary, people get so mad. Yeah. So mad. You put my loved one's body in that casket and somebody else buried it. And I have the casket, of somebody else's loved one. I don't want it. But they're both the same, aren't they? Yeah. Okay, they were different when they were alive. But they're both not alive right now. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm.
And well, have you seen a sky burial? The sky...
Sky burial, yes. That's what I wish were legal. That's what I wish you could do with my body when I die. Yeah? Make it useful. Yeah, I mean, after we die, you don't need it. Yeah, make it useful. Offer it to the birds or the worms or, you know, maybe that's the time to call the cougar over. Yeah. No, feed the cougar.
We all go to prison for a long time.
And the cougars might decide humans are tasty.
Or they might decide they aren't. I don't think cougars, when they're hungry, are that particular, you know. Okay, so in our meditation, we imagine a body that's really died. When we imagine its appearance after 1 day, 2 days, okay, 3, 4, and 5 days, a body that is not embalmed, that is just lying out there this time of year in the sun. Yeah. What's going to happen after a few days? It smells horrible, turns a disgusting color, becomes disfigured, and rots. Yeah. So you might not want to look at a body that has recently died. But at a corpse after a few days, it's a whole other ballgame. Clearly, the end result of this body is nothing desirable. We regard our body as something very dear and take very good care of it, giving it every possible comfort. Yet it will eventually become a corpse that we find very disgusting and fearful. Yeah. If there were a person who appeared so kind, so wonderful to you, but you knew that after some time they would become ugly and violent and really horrible towards you, yeah, you would feel betrayed. Yeah. Wow, you were like this at the beginning and now, ugh. Well, that's kind of what the body is like, you know. When it's alive, we use it, and hopefully for a good purpose. But then, when it dies, it's not so great looking. Yeah. Have you ever noticed that when they show in an obit, they show a picture of somebody when they were alive, when they were smiling. You don't see a picture of what they look like with the dead body. Yeah. Actually, that might be a good Dharma teaching. Yeah? Can have my live body and then what I look like after I'm dead. Yeah. Yeah. Make sure you shave my head. I want to look good. Okay, so clearly the end result of this body is nothing desirable. We regard our body as something very dear and take very good care of it, giving it every possible comfort. Yet it will eventually become a corpse that we find very disgusting and fearful. In addition, while we are alive, our body is the basis of illness and injury. It is the source of much pain, worry, fear, and aggravation. So this is important to meditate on. The purpose of it, we have to be very clear what the purpose is when we do this meditation. It is not so that we loathe our body and say, ugh, this body is terrible, you know, like those monks at the time of the Buddha who said, I want to be free of it. Please kill me so I don't have to be with this body. We're not doing this so that we develop that kind of feeling of repugnancy towards our body as something to live in right now. But we do want to develop it to see that it does not have the nature of something pleasurable and beautiful that's going to be like that forever, you know. So if we see it that way, then we lessen the attachment to it, which is what we want to do, okay? So make sure that you're meditating correctly with the correct attitude here. It's not to hate the body. It's to see it accurately for what it is, so that we are not so attached to it. Okay, so when it's alive, the body is the basis of illness and injury. It is the source of much pain, worry, fear, and aggravation. We have to work hard to feed, clothe, shelter, and protect this body. That is true, isn't it? If we didn't fuss after this body, it would get sick and die very easily. Then we must spend time making it look nice and smell wonderful to disguise its actual looks and odors. We must work hard to earn money so that we can buy the things our body needs and the things our body enjoys. Seeking money, possessions, and resources for the sake of the survival and comfort of our bodies is the basis for fighting wars, cheating others, and becoming greedy, miserly, and fearful. So in your meditation, okay, how does seeking money, possessions, and resources for the survival and comfort of your body, yeah, lead to fighting wars. Yeah. Well, we need a lot of things, and right now, oil is very important for transporting those things, and it's very important for manufacturing some of these things. Yeah. So let's fight about oil. Even though if somebody brought you a quart of oil and put it in front of you, it would be so disgusting smelling and looking that you wouldn't want it. But you want it after they, you know, transform it and put it in the tank where you don't have to smell it. Okay, it becomes the basis for cheating others. Yeah, we want more money to buy the things the body wants. So if you're doing business, you overcharge people. Yeah. Or you lie, you know, about the price of something. It becomes the basis for us becoming greedy and or miserly. Yeah. The body wants to be happy. It also needs money to be healthy. Okay, we're going to have a GoFundMe page. Yeah. I got to get more money. And it's the basis for becoming fearful too. Yeah, how scared we get if we think somebody is threatening this body. Sometimes somebody even comes near you. They don't even touch you. And you're like this. Get out of here. We're afraid. They haven't touched us. Yeah. Very fearful. Yeah. The mosquito lands on you and starts putting their needle in. Yeah, I encountered yesterday when we were in the forest. Those mosquitoes had really pointy. Did you notice that? Their bites really hurt bad, you know. I jumped. I didn't think it was a mosquito. I went, you know, instantly like this. But yeah, I don't know how they got such pointed needles, yeah. Stingers, I guess, yeah. Okay, looking at it from this perspective, we see that the body is the basis for so many troubles, economic problems, environmental pollution. Yeah, the body and taking care of the body is involved in all of these. War, crime, overpopulation, social injustice, all these kinds of problems we have in society are in relationship to the body. Yeah. Through practicing mindfulness of the body, we clearly see that the body is in the nature of dukkha, unsatisfactory. This does not mean that everything about the body is loathsome. Loathsome. Yeah. Okay. It is also the basis that supports our wonderful human intelligence, which, if used properly, enables us to practice Dharma and attain awakening. From this perspective, this body is valuable and a precious human life is treasured. Seeing the body realistically with wisdom, we neither despise it nor are we infatuated with it. So we don't look at the body and go, oh, this is so disgusting and awful and it makes me miserly and greedy and like, I want to get rid of it. You don't look at it that way and you don't look at it, oh, this body gives me so much pleasure and it's so beautiful and I want more and more. I want good food and, you know, a back massage, you know, really, yeah. And I want this and that. Okay. So we keep our body clean and relatively comfortable so that it can be utilized for Dharma practice. Balance is crucial. On the one hand, we value this body and use it to engage in positive actions. Dharma practice, and activities that benefit ourselves and others. On the other hand, attachment to the body leads to self-indulgence as well as anger when the body becomes ill, is in pain, and dies. You know, you have this great weekend planned. You're going to go out skiing or surfing or doing ballroom dancing or, you know, whatever, you know, looking at Picasso paintings, and the body gets sick. What a bummer, yeah? Okay, so it's that on one hand. On the other hand, this human body is what enables us to make progress on the path. It's the best vehicle for progress on the path. Okay, a balanced perspective relates to the body in a healthy way. We know that our present body is true dukkha, yet we must protect it because it is the basis of our precious human life. Okay, let's pause here. Questions, comments?
In thinking about this week, about the person being in the body, I was surprised to find in my own mind how, you know, in the 37 practices, we talk about the guest house of the body, leave the guest house of the body. Leave the guest house of the body. It's in the verses in the 37 practices.
Yeah.
Right?
Leave
the guest house of the body. Right? Uh-huh. So I was just surprised to see how I've kind of adopted, that's it. That's the guest house. So it's still the me that's in that guest house that's going to go on. It was just illuminating, like, you've even taken the Dharma into this wrong view.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because everything truly exists. Yeah. But the body is like a guest house.
Yes.
You live in it for a while, and then you leave. Yeah. Like the airplane seat. I think I told you about that. Yeah. When I got on a plane one time after I was flying back after giving a teaching on the five forces when alive and dying, you know. And somebody was in the seat that was my seat. My boarding pass was proof that it was my seat. I was quite attached to that seat because it was a long flight and I did not want to sit in the middle seat that was her seat. I wanted my seat. But it was so interesting. The plane landed, and as soon as we could get up, I got up. And then I no longer cared who sat in that seat. Yeah, anybody could have sat in that seat. And it really struck me. It's like, okay, 1 minute ago, this is mine. Nobody else can sit here. And then 1 minute later, I don't care what happens to it. So interesting. Other questions, comments?
I think also attempting to visualize yourself in different forms as different deities shows me how attached I am to this form because it's like a different color. It's like,
Or sometimes I'm green.
Yeah. Or 16-year-old boy to me is always like, ew. Sorry, I have to like, wait, stop. Because I taught high school. They're all like, ew, they're just smelly after PE, you know? I'm like, no, that's not what you're trying to imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, 16-year-old. But yeah, Manjushri is a 16-year-old. Yeah, Chenrai, six. Yeah. Yeah, after you teach them, it's like,
When I first started going to see a dermatologist decades ago, just for sun damage, those offices were not promoting Botox and lifts and plastics and all enhancements. They were just a place where you went because there was something going wrong with your skin. Mm-hmm. And now everyone who's got a medical license almost can learn how to inject Botox because it is a $1 billion industry. And so just thinking about the cost of it first, and it's very unpleasant. You know, we're talking about pleasant, unpleasant. It's very unpleasant to get shot with Botox, apparently, and it only lasts for 3 months. So you have to keep going back. You have to keep checking in the mirror to see, is it still working?
Or did it sag?
There's this cost.
You have to push it up.
I don't think Medicare covers the cost of this, or health care. And so it's just so bizarre. And then people feel they have to do this so they can stay in their job. And one of our friends years ago, like even before the Botox craze, she was telling us she still had to dye her hair. And she at that time was maybe in her late 30s. But, you know, she was just going naturally white, just genetically. But she had to keep dyeing her hair to stay viable and respected in her profession. She knew that she would be released. So it's very tragic what we...
Yeah. Just for appearance sake, as if appearance were important.
Having the same similar experience as Venerable Sumpton, but when you go into these places now with all the hype about all the plastic surgery, the majority of patients are farmers and ranchers and loggers who spent way too much time outside making a living, and now their skin is, they have a lot of skin cancer. So when you go in there, the reality of who's sitting in the waiting room and what's going on the screens, there's a totally discordant reality.
Yeah.
That a lot of people are dealing with skin cancer who had worked hard outside in their lives and didn't protect themselves. And it's very interesting.
Anything else? Okay. We don't want bed bugs crawling on this precious body. Yeah. Or little spiders. Yeah. I have quite a variety of spiders where I live, you know. There was one this morning, so small, I initially thought it was just a speck of dirt. It was a teeny weeny itsy bitsy spider. And it was in the sink. And how do I get it out of the sink? Because it's so delicate and fragile, you know. And then you walk around the Buddha Hall outside here. There's, spiders this big, and then some one that are this big. If you go to India, then you have a spider that's that big. Yeah. But we don't want even the small ones crawling on this precious thing. Yeah. Okay, let's dedicate. Wow, we did 2 pages. But I think there's a lot in these 2 pages. Mm-hmm.